Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters.
Hello, in 1177 BC, a series of very unfortunate events culminated in the collapse of numerous kingdoms centered upon the Western Mediterranean. The nature of those events and how one played upon the other was the topic of my conversation with Eric Klein way back in episode 60. That was like 8 years ago, when we talked about his book, 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed. Now Eric Klein is back on the podcast to answer one of the great questions ever asked by small children about stories or history. And then what happened? That is also the task of his most recent book, After 1177 BC, The Survival of Civilizations. We shall talk about those who survived, those who didn't, and why. Eric H. Klein is professor of classics and anthropology at George Washington University. His most recent book is 1177 BC, A Graphic History of the Year Civilization Collapsed, and is also published by Princeton University Press. So, Eric, let's recap with the events from when last we talked. You notice I was very careful in the introduction to say kingdoms collapsed, but you know the title of your book did stake out the year civilization collapsed. First of all, what were those events that led to a catastrophe, or certainly in the Eastern Mediterranean? What were those events? What were those sort of catastrophes? Why are you so precise? How can you be so precise? I remember asking you this back then.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for having me back on. It's a pleasure to be here again. Those questions that you just asked will take the rest of the day to answer just right there. So there's a lot there to unpack, but, all right, let me see if I can kind of start from the beginning.
But you'll do it in 5 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right, a thumbnail sketch. So at the end of the Late Bronze Age, in the decades after 1200 BC, society, civilization, the interconnected network, that's probably the best way to put it, of the societies in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean collapsed. At the time, there had been a flourishing group, what I call the G8 of the ancient world, Mycenaeans and Minoans in the Aegean area, the Hittites up in Anatolia, what is today modern Turkey, the Egyptians, the Cypriots, the Assyrians and Babylonians over in Mesopotamia, and the Canaanites in the Levant, right? Modern Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. Those eight or nine have been interacting happily for about 300 years by that point. And it is what some have called a globalized Mediterranean. Let's put it that way. Round about, as I say, just after 1200 BC, something happens and that network collapses. The individual societies are each affected to a different degree and react differently. And that's what we will be talking about for the rest of the podcast. But what happened that caused it? Hard to say, because there are so many different possibilities. It is very much, as you said in the introduction, it is a series of unfortunate events. Near as we can figure out, we have a series of earthquakes, we have some disease, we have drought, we have famine, we have migrations and invaders. And in the past, historians and archaeologists have usually pointed to one or another and said that's the reason. I, in my original book, which came out in 2014, I pointed to them all and I said, that's it. It was a perfect storm. That's what happened. So if you look at these, any one of them would not have caused the collapse of one society, let alone all of them. So earthquakes, yes, they kill a lot of people, but it doesn't end a society or a civilization. Same thing with drought, same thing with famine. But if you have them all at the same time, or one right after another, so that you can't recover from the one before the next hits, that's where you've got a problem like this. And that's what I think happens. Now, as to how we can be so precise, it's thanks to the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses III. Ramses III says that a series of people, groups of people that we call the Sea Peoples, but that he specified, he gave us their names, the Peleset, the Weshesh, the Ekwesh, the Shardana, the Shekelesh, and so on. He said that they invaded Egypt. And according to our chronologies, we see that year, which he tells us, as 1177. So that's how we can get that precise. Now, of course, if you go with a different Egyptian chronology, that same year could be seen as 1186. And at one point, that was the name of the book. But then I decided that I liked the chronology by Ken Kitchen of University of Liverpool better, and he put that year at 1177. So that's how we can be that precise. But I also need to say that 1177 is not the year that civilization collapsed. It is a benchmark. It is one of the years while the network was collapsing. It's very much like when we say the Roman Empire fell in 476. It didn't, right? It took most of the 5th century. And even after that, you've got the Eastern Roman Empire for another 1,000 years. Same thing here. We tell our kids 476 is the fall of Rome. I say 1177 is the collapse of the Late Bronze Age, knowing full well that it actually took about a century, and it's what we call a systems collapse, when your central government goes away, centralized economy, and all of that. So it is a bit of a misnomer. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's clickbait, but definitely numbers in titles sell better than wordy descriptions, as my editor said. He spent 5 years persuading me that we should call it 1177 when I wanted to call it anything but. But he was right. He was right. So,
yeah. Well, maybe in the third edition, you'll change that. Maybe you'll go back to a different chronology, and that will, right. That will spice things up. You reserve the right to be wrong, which is fine. Can we talk about some of the things that were not important, or some of the myths? Because, you know, growing up on like maybe the National Geographic wonders or mysteries of the ancient world, mm-hmm. probably that was like influential to you too. Many archaeological careers must have been launched with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I heard of this, or talk about Plato's Atlantis. Santorini is always mentioned, and the explosion of Santorini. And of course, and then we'll get to the Dorian invasion, which I can kind of remember some picture from like the 8th grade European history textbook of strange bearded people descending into, you know, Greece. And man, what a hell of a mess that was mm-hmm. in my head. So let's go with Santorini and then with the Dorian invasion.
So
why are those not things?
Right. Okay. So first of all, Santorini and the eruption. It is a thing, but it's not a thing.
It happened
for sure, but it is not related to the collapse of the Late Bronze Age. Why not? Because it happens 400 years before the end of the Bronze Age. The nearest we can figure out now, and this has been debated for decades now, it looks like the eruption of Santorini, which is this island about 70 miles north of Crete, it happened either in 1628 BC or at about 1550 BC or somewhere in between, somewhere in those 75 years in between. So if it erupts in, let's call it, the 17th or 16th centuries, and the Late Bronze Age collapse in the 12th century, that's a good 400 years. Okay, so, however,
somewhat delayed.
A little bit delayed, yes. But I will say that makes an interesting point, because the eruption of Santorini greatly impacted the Minoan civilization on Crete at that time. But they bounced back. They were resilient. It's actually a really good example of how a catastrophe, be it, you know, Mother Nature, like a volcanic eruption, does not necessarily spell the end of your society. And there have been a lot of such catastrophes throughout history, the vast majority of which did not result in a societal collapse. So Santorini is one very good example. But whenever I give my lectures and I do not mention Santorini because I'm not talking about it, somebody says, well, why'd you leave out the volcano? And I'm like, because it's not relevant. And they're like, of course it is. And then they try and say, well, there were ripple effects for 400 years. I'm like, no, there weren't. Not at all. So Santorini, absolutely fascinating. Yes, it might be the basis for the myth of Atlantis.
It is. But, yeah. It is the obvious volcano, yeah. So eyes tend to be attracted to that bright, glowing lava object. And you know, given what we know about climactic change through history, you know, there's probably some volcano somewhere in the Philippines or Indonesia or Iceland that was popping off sometime around, you know, at this time and changing the climate in the Western Mediterranean. But it's really hard to establish that at this point.
I would imagine. There is actually one. Just as you said just now, that's up north Iceland area, Hekla, Hekla 3.
Yeah.
The Hekla 3 eruption may have impacted part of the collapse, but it's a little too late. It blows up in about 1100 BC, so the collapse has already been going for a century by that point, but it may have contributed, yes. There's also possibilities that Mount Etna in Sicily may have erupted in the 13th century. One person has suggested that Santorini got a little bit active again, a little bit frisky in about 1200, but I haven't seen many people follow that. But anyway, so of all the various possibilities, I discount volcanoes to a certain extent. The other thing, though, that one needs to keep in mind, and when I was younger, not necessarily with National Geographic, but in classes in college and graduate school, I was originally taught that the sea peoples were responsible for the collapse, that they came across, destroyed all the civilizations, brought the Bronze Age to an end, and they were this, you know, the boogeyman that the archaeologists tell their kids, if you don't go to sleep, the sea peoples are going to get you, right?
Sea people's going to get you for
exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the conclusions that I came to in writing the original book is that while the sea peoples are definitely a factor, and we can see them and we've got records about them, they are still very mysterious. We're not sure where they come from, and we're not 100% sure where they go to, though Ramses does say that he beats them and he settles them in his strongholds, which would mean Egypt and Canaan. But near as we can figure out, it was a little bit more peaceful than one might expect based on just the Egyptian records. And you can't always trust the Egyptian records at face value. But also, they look like they are as much victims as they were oppressors. And what I think now, having looked at all the evidence, is that they are essentially migrants in search of a better life, in search of better lands. And if they are coming from the Western Mediterranean, as we tend to think these days, from Sicily, from Sardinia, from northern Italy, and then sweeping across Greece and what is now Turkey, and then Cyprus and North Syria before heading to Egypt, it looks like they're affected by the drought at that time, and therefore famine, and therefore they're moving. And I would say the modern parallels, or fairly modern, would be like the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, where everybody moved from Oklahoma to California. Or even more recently, all of the refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria, or the people trying to get into Europe from Africa. We have migrations today for much the same reasons. that they would have had it back then. So I, in the book, discounted the sea peoples to a certain extent. And I say they are one of the factors, but they're as much, you know, a symptom as they are a problem. So I kind of did away with them as well and said they're just part of the larger picture.
So at the beginning of this book, get back to the Dorian invasion or Dorian migration, you call that into question. You observe that it's one of these sort of brain worms that just will not die. That it's something that you professionals haven't really talked about for decades. And yet the rest of us, we still have the Dorian invasion, Dorian migration, whatever, on our brain. Now, I'm going to push. You've just been describing a migration of the sea peoples. Why can't other people migrate into Greece? I don't quite understand.
They certainly can. And I'd be happy with a Dorian migration. And that's what I actually say in this new book. The beginning of this new book, I tried to parallel the original book, 1177. Mm-hmm. 1177 began with the sea peoples. That's the prologue. And after 1177 begins with the Dorian invasion. And I describe these warriors sweeping down from the north, wielding weapons of iron and overrunning Greece, you know, 80 years after the Trojan War. And then I say, but it probably never happened. And indeed, as you've said, archaeologists for decades now, since the 1960s, have been saying the Dorian invasion is not an invasion. It did not happen that way. That's what Herodotus and Thucydides tried to tell us happened, but archaeologically, there's no evidence for it, right? There's no evidence for an invasion. Now, that doesn't mean there's not a migration, but, you know, there's a huge amount of difference, not just semantic, between invasion and migration. Invasions, you know, they do. You've got these warriors with weapons of iron and all of that, and it's a sudden, sharp, cataclysmic event. Migration is generally much more gradual and frequently much more peaceful. I have no problem with people moving around immediately after the collapse. In fact, that's probably what happens quite a bit. People are migrating in addition to dying, but they're not invading per se. So just like I had a problem with the sea peoples invading, so I have a problem with the Dorians invading. And I'm not alone with this. I'm citing in the beginning of the book any number of other scholars that say this is really interesting. It's an invasion without invaders, for example. But also, as you said, in our writings, archaeologists, ancient historians, we discounted the Dorian invasion long ago. The general public is not aware of that. And you will still see people talking about the Dorians and the Dorian invasion all over the internet, for one thing. I mean, it's everywhere on the internet. But it's also still in our textbooks, in high school textbooks, in college textbooks. It was even in a textbook that I use. There's 3 pages on the Dorian invasion. And I say to the students, read this, and then we're going to rip the pages out of the textbook because it's just wrong. Right. So the general public has not gotten the message, and that is our fault that we haven't gotten the message out. So that's one of the things I try to do is discount that.
It's interesting because this, of course, this is something that the ancient Greek historians are using to explain themselves to themselves. Yes. So it has a long what's the line from Animal House? It has a long record of existence. That's sort of it has that going for it.
Yes.
But if not much else, like evidence and things.
Yeah, but the ancients were trying to explain why you had different dialects of Greek, why you had Doric versus Ionic versus. But you know, that doesn't mean they were right, and indeed it doesn't look like they were. Not a good explanation. In terms of invasion, just replace invasion with migration and we're good. That's all it takes, really. But it's not an invasion per se. And I go into detail in a chapter a little later in the book, that the Dorians did not necessarily have iron weapons. Iron is not invented until after the collapse. I mean, yes, it's around. There's meteoric iron. There's even a dagger in King Tut's tomb, which has an iron blade. But they don't start working iron per se, and iron doesn't start taking over for bronze until after the collapse. So the Dorians don't have that. The Sea Peoples don't have iron weapons. There's a lot of myth out there that we need to address. Now that we know things better from the archaeology, and in part that's why I wanted to write this book, was to say, hey, things have changed. Here is the current state of our knowledge. And I would say about 75% of the book is a straight history book with archaeology tossed in, saying, look, this is what we think right now, people. And then only in the last chapter or so do I say, okay, now let's analyze this. But I really wanted to set the archaeology and the historical record, I wanted to make it accurate for people today.
Well, let's gallop through the G8 of the ancient world, because you have such a gift for coining phrases like that. Let's look at the civilizational horse race, if I can call it that. This is I hate it when people on cable talk shows talk about winners and losers. And that's exactly what we're going to do for like 20 or 30 minutes. I mean, these are the ultimate sweepstakes, whether or not your kingdom / civilization gets to survive. So let's begin with the big mother, Egypt. What are the effects? What is Egypt's civilizational response to this, what might be called a challenge?
Yeah, so there are definitely winners and losers here. And in the book, I don't call it a horse race, but I do call it a foot race. And I say, it's the same thing. Everyone is starting from the same starting line, if you will, that is the collapse. And then when you get to the finish line, they all finish at different times, and some don't finish at all. So in the analyses at the end of the book, what I do is I literally rank them. Who did the best? Who did the worst? Who came in the middle? It's basically 8 case studies of what to do or not to do if your society collapses, which is why I think there are lessons to be learned for us today that we can get along the way. So Egypt is right smack in the middle of everybody. They are not the best, and they are by no means the worst. I actually rank the societies in terms of numerical categories, which I define in the book, but 1 is the best, and 5 is the worst. The Egyptians are 3. They come right in the middle. And I tend to use terms that are batted around today, but I think are relevant to back then as well. Things like adapting and coping and transformation, all these, you know, different nuances of resilience. So the Egyptians are able to cope. That means they're basically dealing, you know, moment to moment. They're not necessarily adapting, which is where you're looking ahead a little bit, you know, a couple months, a year, whatever. And they're definitely not transforming, which means you're just, you know, getting ready for the long haul. But they are coping. So what do the Egyptians do? They basically pull back from the international stage. We know they leave Canaan by about 1140, 1130 BC, you know, and they've controlled Canaan for 200-300 years by this point. Now they pull back. They still have their king. They still have the religion, all of that. But they actually have too many kings, because Egypt, part of this period in the 4 centuries after the collapse, which is what I'm looking at from the 12th century down to the 8th century. Part of this in Egypt is what we call the Third Intermediate Period, which is a period of anarchy and chaos anyway. So at one point, there are no fewer than 3 or even 4 different people, each saying that they are the pharaoh of Egypt, and they're each ruling in a different part of the country. So, you know, that's not good. If you're Egypt, you're supposed to have one pharaoh and he rules over everything. So I would say that's not a really good adaptation, shall we say. But they do survive. They do survive. And they survive intact. Like I said, the government's still there. The religion is still there and all of that. So it could have been a lot worse. And in fact, it was worse for other people. But it could have been better as well. Now, there are some high points. And I'll just name one or two. You've got, for instance, Shoshank, Pharaoh Shoshank, who may be Shishak of the Bible, the one who comes up and attacks Jerusalem just after Solomon dies. There are a fair number of scholars. There are a fair number of scholars, myself included, who think that Shoshank and Shishak are probably the same guy. Rules somewhere around 945 to 925 BC. And that would be a high point. He actually, Shoshank founds the 22nd dynasty in Egypt. He's of Libyan descent. There are others as well. There's one guy who's been nicknamed the Silver Pharaoh because his tomb is incredibly wealthy. If King Tut's tomb hadn't been found, this guy, Pusenes, would have been the wealthiest tomb found. But it was discovered in 1939. And overshadowed by the outbreak of World War II. So not many people have heard of him. So there are these high points, but overall, as I say, Egypt is kind of middle of the road in terms of surviving. And they're really not ever the same again. Basically, the Late Bronze Age, the 18th, 19th dynasties, was their high point in terms of, you know, being a great international power. They're on their own. They're not really that ever again.
So the edges of Egypt become really interesting, especially Canaan. So get back to, not to beat on National Geographic, but not that long ago, I was, you know, reading some Israeli archaeologists explain to me that, you know, David was as real as Robin Hood. But it would seem that in this civilizational reset, let's call it, of this period, the peripheries and lots of peripheries are opening up. And you can do various things. You can found cities in Ionia, for example. We'll get to that eventually. But there's also, it's possible to recreate Canaanite civilization and maybe even establish a Judean kingdom. So can we talk briefly about Israel and then what's happening along, then we can segue to the, what's happening along the coasts of the Mediterranean as well? Slightly to just nearby.
Sure, sure. So, in fact, when Egypt pulls out of this region, that has a huge impact on what is happening here. And the collapse also has a big impact, obviously. So, the big kingdoms, the big empires that had been around in the Late Bronze Age, the Egyptians, the Hittites, Assyrians, Babylonians, as they get impacted by the collapse, and they retreat and have to deal with their own internal affairs, it opens up essentially a power vacuum for new peoples to emerge. And that's exactly what happens in this period, this Iron Age. And it may be that some of them are simply coming out from under the shadow of the bigger kingdoms. It may be that others are migrating in. And so this is actually a question and a problem we've got in some instances, including in what we would now call Israel. In at that time, let's call it the southern Levant, the Canaanites that are there, who we can see in things like the Amarna letters from the 14th century, we know there are little city-states, if you will, little tiny kingdoms, ruled by vassal rulers at Jerusalem, Megiddo, Hazor, Lachish, who owed allegiance to usually the Egyptians, but the ones farther north up in northern Syria owed allegiance to the Hittites. Now, as both the Hittites moved back and ultimately collapsed, and the Egyptians retreated and are busy dealing with the chaos in their own country, the Canaanites up and down, not just Israel, but Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, they each react in different ways. So if we start in the south and move up, we've got a question of what happens to the Canaanites in the southern Levant. And that is something that I have wrestled with, because what we suddenly see in the Iron Age is, as you just mentioned, a couple of new kingdoms. Not only do we have now the kingdom of Judah, we've also got the kingdom of Israel, but we also have the kingdom of Edom, and another one of Moab, and another of Ammon. We get a series of little kingdoms down there. And the question is related to the date, for example, of the Exodus and of the Israelite conquest of Canaan. When did the Exodus take place? When did the Israelites conquer Canaan? And you know, I go into it in a little bit of detail in this book because it's relevant. But you know, if the Exodus took place in about 1250 BC, which many archaeologists think, they're actually, the Israelites are leaving Egypt and coming up to Canaan in the aftermath, or just as the collapse is happening. In other words, they're taking advantage of the chaos. But there are others who suggest that the Exodus may have happened earlier. If you follow biblical chronology, it could be as early as 1450 BC. And so there are problems with that. And that impacts us, because if the Israelites had already gotten there earlier and were living like up in the highlands, which some archaeologists have suggested, then what they would have done is come down from the highlands into the area that's just been vacated by the Egyptians. And it may be that they're just transforming, in which case they're dealing really well with the aftermath of the collapse, and they'd be up, you know, at number one. But if they're just coming in now with the Exodus, they would be migrating, and they wouldn't have survived the collapse, if you will. They'd be migrating into territory that's now vacated. But that's, you know, Kingdom of Israel, Kingdom of Judah. Kingdom of Ammon may have had, and Edom may have had nomads who settled down. But my question is, what happened to the original Canaanites, the people who were in Jerusalem, Lachish, Megiddo, Hazor? Because if you look in the Hebrew Bible, in one place it says there's a genocide, and you know the Israelites coming in just massacred everybody. But in another, it says they settled down and lived side by side. You know, this is the book of Joshua versus the book of Judges. So which do you believe? And so in terms of the Canaanites and trying to rank them, I've actually put them at my lowest. I put them at number five. They did not transform. They either got wiped out or they got assimilated. But we don't see Canaanite society per se after the late Bronze Age. What we see instead is Israelite society, Edomite society, Moab, Moabite society. Are these just different names for the same people, or are they new peoples? So we've got a question there. The other parts of Canaan, the central part and the northern part, are both very different stories. And we might want to save those for when we talk about the Hittites and about Phoenicia and Cyprus.
Yeah, let's talk about the Hittites first, because they are, I guess, they are your biggest losers in this foot race. More than anyone else, they become a memory faster than any other of these groups.
Yes.
So let's talk about them, and some of the people that then crawled out from underneath the wreckage, which are, I guess, the Cypriots and the Phoenicians.
Right.
If we're allowed to say Phoenicians, let's not get into that right now. That's another hour.
Right.
Go on. So let's start with the Hittites and move on to the other two.
Right. Okay. And we shouldn't leave out Assyria and Babylon as well over in Mesopotamia. But
no, we'll get to them.
They're in there too. But yeah, the Hittites, you can make a TV show about it and call it the Biggest Losers, right? So yeah, the Hittites of all the groups, I think, are the least successful in dealing with the collapse of their society. That doesn't mean that everyone dies, though a lot of them do. But it means that the central administration disappears, the economy goes away, everything changes. The royal family is dead, everybody's migrated, new peoples have taken over. So the Hittites, yes, they are on my list of the people that do the worst in terms of dealing with this. They are the best example of what not to do. Now, why didn't they deal very well with it is a question that's hard to answer. It's difficult to answer any of these. But I think in this case, there were any number of things that went wrong anyway for the Hittites. For example, they had already abandoned their capital city of Hattusas and had moved south to a place called Tarhuntassa. There were schisms in the royal family. They already had their own problems, and then they're exacerbated by the collapse. They're also affected by the drought. We know they're affected by famine. We have it in their letters. They're writing to the Egyptian king, asking for help. Send us food. We're all starving here. It's a matter of life and death. So the Hittites do not do very well. And they are eventually supplanted. If you go further to the west in Anatolia, modern Turkey, you get to the region where the Phrygians come in and take over. Not quite all the way to the west coast, but getting there. The area of Gordian, where you've got later King Midas ruling. But way to the east, we've got Urartu and the Urartians coming in and establishing their own society. By the way, from Urartu, we get Mount Ararat. That's where the name basically comes from. And so they take over. It's a new society that has arisen in the ruins of the Hittite Empire at that time. Now,
so can I just ask one question? I mean, the Hittites, their location is central Anatolia, or the Anatolian Highlands.
They're in central Anatolia.
So, in addition to everything else, and we're going to get to a little Talebian terminology. They're already in a sort of a fragile ecosystem, yes. Right? I mean, it's arid. It's yes. the great killer app of Egypt. Well, that's bureaucracy. But their great geographical reason for existence is they have the Nile and the Nile floods. Yes. There are and we'll get to Assyria and Babylon. They have the Tigris and the Euphrates. Right. They have all the drainage from the Anatolian highlands. The Hittites are in the highlands, and so maybe the Hittite Empire was founded at a time of sort of maximum, least aridity, maximum sort of rainfall. It was better when it was founded, but it was just too precarious to last.
That would be part of it. And the Hittites, I mean, they really begin in about 1700 BC. So you know they've been going for 500 years by the time of the collapse. The capital city of Hattusas is only captured once in that entire time, but it's by a group called the Kashka that come from the northeast, up almost by the Black Sea. And in fact, it looks like it's the Kashka that come in again in about 1200 when Hattusas has been abandoned. Looks like the Kashka come in and then burn it just for good measure. But yes, the lack of water is going to be a problem. And I do point that out in the book, that much as you've just said, the Egyptians had the Nile, the Assyrians and Babylonians had the Tigris and the Euphrates. The Hittites had the Halys River, but it's not that big. So I do say in the conclusions to the book that one of the things that we shouldn't underestimate is the importance of water, and that you know, resonates today also. And that I would say, out of our G8, the four that were the most important were the Hittites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. And of those, the Hittites are the only ones that totally go down. And yes, I would say it was in part because of the water, so that when the drought hit, they were not able to deal with it as well as the others. I do think that's why Egypt was able to maintained at least at a level 3 was because of the Nile. But even they are hit by drought. We see it in the records, and we see it in the archaeology too. Assyria and Babylonia hit also, but not as bad because of the rivers right there. Now, the one thing, though, to keep in mind, even when you have a total societal collapse, is not everybody will collapse, and especially, and as you've referred to a couple times already, on the peripheries. The peripheries are where people tend to survive and where the traditions might continue. So even though the main heartland of the empire up in central Anatolia is gone, on the periphery, people continue things. So in North Syria, we have what are known as the Neo-Hittites or the Syro-Hittites, and they continue the traditions, including writing in hieroglyphic script, Luwian, which had the Hittites had used it mostly for royal inscriptions. We see that continuing in the Neo-Hittite kingdoms. They're little ones, that Carchemish, for example, Aleppo, and so on, but they continue for another 400 years, and they are the Hittites of the Bible. When the Bible talks about Hittites, they are talking about the Neo-Hittites, because the main Hittites are already gone. So the way that I usually look at it, it's as if, you know, the British Empire is long gone, and yet in the former colonies or whatever of the British Empire, people still play cricket, people still drink tea in the afternoons, even though there is no British Empire anymore. Same thing with the Neo-Hittites. They continue Hittite tradition. They claim they're descended, and in fact, they may well be. Some of the kings of Carchemish, for example, are completely descended from the family of Shupiluliuma I, who ruled back in the 14th century. And so you do have some survivors. I will not say it's 100% wiped out. But that's where I also have to differentiate. The Hittites, per se, I give them a 5. They don't survive. The Neo-Hittites down in northern Syria, I put them up in like category 2. They're actually pretty resilient. They're actually able to transform to a certain extent, and they survive until they get wiped out by the Neo-Assyrians when they come back with their new empire. So the question is, you know, what did the Hittites do and what did they not do in order to, you know, not make the transition?
So let's talk about some of the real, I guess these are, the, I think the Phoenicians are, you have it at 1, and the Cypriots, are they at a 1? Yes. The Cypriots don't run off they don't come to mind immediately for most people. The Phoenicians, perhaps more so. Why do the Cypriots and then the Phoenicians succeed briefly?
Right. So they are at number 1. And just to put things relative here, remember the Egyptians are at 3. In between, Assyria and Babylonia are 2s because they continue. Mm-hmm. They've got the kings, they've got the writing, everything just keeps going. They transform a little bit, but they're really coping and adapting, and they're doing pretty well. The Phoenicians and the Cypriots blow everybody else out of the water. Literally, the water in this case being the Mediterranean, because they take over. They transform so well, they adapt so well, they cope so well, they are anti-fragile. This is a term that Nassim Nicholas Taleb has used. It's actually the title of one of his books. Definition of anti-fragile is flourishing in the age of chaos. And taking advantage.
Flourishing, not just despite pressure, but because of pressure. It creates that.
Yes, they are taking advantage of the chaos, taking advantage of other people's problems to flourish and to succeed, basically, you know, at the expense of others. So in this particular case, one of the things that's happened, because of the internationalized network that has collapsed, trade has gone downhill temporarily. It's been cut. Basically, you've got the Egyptians are no longer sailing the seas. Hittites are no longer sailing the seas. And the site of Ugarit, which had been a major port on the coast of what is now North Syria, Ugarit has been overrun and is burnt to the ground and is abandoned. Nobody lives in Ugarit for 400 years. So Ugarit had been sending ships, for example, back and forth to Minoan Crete. We know this. There's a tablet with a merchant named Cineranu who was importing grain and olive oil and beer from Crete all the way up to Syria. When Ugarit leaves the picture, the Phoenicians and the Cypriots take advantage of this. And as one of my friends and colleagues, Carol Bell, has said, the Mediterranean became a Phoenician lake. And that's exactly what happens. Mm-hmm. So we get Phoenicians and we get Cypriots sailing the sea, the Mediterranean, going to Greece, going over to Italy.
Do you think that, I mean, this is a terrible question to ask, and it shows that I'm a modern historian, but is it the Phoenicians that create sort of one of the Phoenicians' greatest creations was with Carthage. It's a colony. And then the Carthage goes and makes lots of other colonies. And one of the really interesting things about just prior to recorded Greek history is places like Miletus, which the number of Greek colonies that are being planted everywhere from modern Spain to the far reaches of the Black Sea is really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be one of the, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I'm getting ahead of myself here, but it seems to be one of the consequences of the vacuums that are opened up by these collapses is this colonizing frenzy. And I mean, what do you think is the reason for it? Why has it always been happening? Is this just the first time that we've seen it in our vision, or what's the reason?
Well,
for this?
We are getting way ahead of ourselves here, but. Because we have Phoenician colonization, but that's not going to start until the 9th century with, as you say, like Carthage in North Africa.
And Miletus, much later than that, for sure.
The Greek colonization, as you mentioned, like Miletus, that is 7th century. That's even later. And in fact, I'm going to be discussing that in the next book. There is going to be a third book in what I'm now calling the unintentional trilogy. The third book is the first book is 1177 BC. The second book is after 1177 BC. The third book should technically be after 1177, but no, it's going to be called 776 BC with the beginning of the Greek Olympics. That's when you start getting Greek colonization and the Panhellenic period and all of that. And that, in part, is due to overpopulation in the Greek city-states and all of that. But that is not going to come until after the period that we're talking about in this current new book. Right? So they have to – Greece, we haven't even gotten to Greece. Greece is going to have to rebuild.
We're about to
exactly.
Get there.
So let's leave that.
Do you think the Phoenicians and the Cypriots, are they experiencing overpopulation relatively quickly after this collapse?
I don't think you'd necessarily overpopulation. It's possible. But I think there are other things that are motivating them. And in part, what's motivating both the Phoenicians and the Cypriots is overseas markets. Both things that they want to sell and things that they need. So, for example, we now know that the Phoenicians are going all the way to Spain, certainly by the 9th century and maybe as early as the 11th century. What do they want in Spain? They want the silver. They are bringing back Iberian silver. We can see it in the objects that have been excavated in what is now Israel and Lebanon. The Phoenicians are getting silver. What are they trading in return? Purple dye. The Phoenicians are famous for their purple dye. Now, they don't invent purple dye. Purple dye is already being used back in the Bronze Age, but they perfect it. And so the Phoenicians become known for this. The other thing that they perfect, they don't invent it, they standardize it, is the alphabet. And that's what we mostly know the Phoenicians for today, is the invention of the alphabet, but it's not the invention. It's already been around for a couple hundred years by that point, but they standardize it. And they bring it to Greece, and they also bring it to Italy. So it becomes the Phoenician writing system, the Phoenician alphabet becomes the Greek alphabet, and it becomes the Latin alphabet. And of course, we're still using both today, right? Greek alphabet's used to write Greek. Latin alphabet is, you know, we use it for English, French, Spanish, Italian, all the Romance languages. We're using the Latin alphabet. So the Phoenicians spread that. But in terms of overpopulation, yes, possibly. But we also have to remember that the Phoenicians themselves never actually called themselves Phoenicians. That's the later Greek name for them. If you asked a guy from central Canaan, who are you? He'd say, I'm from the city of Tyre. I'm from the city of Sidon. I'm from the city of Beirut. And what they actually are central Canaanites from the late Bronze Age who have survived. Central Canaan, they have survived. They are anti-fragile. They are direct descendants. They're not migrants. They've always been there, and they survived. Now, whether that means they start getting overpopulated in the early Iron Age, possible. We don't know for sure because most of those Phoenician cities from that time period are underneath the modern cities that are still there. So it's very hard to excavate them, very hard to get an idea of what the population might have been like. But we have found a number of inscriptions. We know the names of quite a few of the kings of Byblos. We know the names of some of the kings of Tyre. Right? We also find them in the Hebrew Bible, like Hiram of Tyre, who helps King Solomon, supposedly. So we know a lot about them, and yet there's a lot more that we need to know. So the Phoenicians are anti-fragile. They flourish in this time of chaos, utilizing the alphabet, purple dye, and going out on the Mediterranean. The Cypriots, similarly, they make the transition. We're now thinking that I mentioned earlier about the new use of iron, that it comes into greater use after the collapse. And why that is, we're not quite sure. Is there a shortage of tin? Is there a shortage of copper? That's what we used to think, that maybe the supply chain had been cut. And if you can't get tin, you can't make bronze, then you got to do something else. Now it's debated. Now we're thinking maybe it wasn't cut off. But regardless, the Cypriots, who had been producing most of the copper during the Bronze Age, now seem to be the first people that start producing iron. The process is quite different, you know, making bronze versus making iron, but it does look like the Cypriots do it the earliest. There are knives and daggers that are bimetallic, two different metals. You've got the blade made of iron, but the haft would have had bronze rivets. You've got both bronze and iron. And those, it looks like the earliest ones are made on Cyprus, and then they're exported. We find them both in Greece, and we find them in the southern Levant. And it looks like the Cypriots are exporting the know-how, the technology, along with the objects. And, you know, iron ore is found in all the countries. And as soon as you learn how to work it, you can do it yourself. So it looks like the Cypriots, their contribution is iron and how to work it. And that spreads very quickly. And so they are also then anti-fragile, and they've transformed because they switch from bronze to iron. Doesn't mean they stop making bronze. They're still doing that. But iron now takes over. And they also sail the seas. So Cypriots and Phoenicians are almost lockstep. Wherever we find one, we find the other in terms of sailing to the Aegean and the Western Mediterranean. So I put them at the top of my chart. They do, those two did the best.
So we've got about 10 minutes left. And so I just wanted to, we have to conclude very quickly with the civilization probably gets the most attention because it's Greekish, I guess. And it certainly, it would seem to me the Mycenaeans are contenders along with the Hittites for having gone from first to worst. But things don't end well for the Mycenaeans. But as we'll see, that's kind of good for us.
Yes, I guess you could put it that way. Yeah, I actually put the Mycenaeans and Minoans in category 4, that they do not adapt well. They don't make the transition, but they're not gone completely. We still have the people in the lands. Now, a lot of them do die. A lot of them do migrate. At one point, we thought that upwards of 90% had either died or migrated. Now it's been ratcheted back, and we're thinking maybe 40 to 60%, somewhere in there, died. Yeah.
That's kind of huge. I mean, that's gone from unimaginable to catastrophic.
Yes.
I mean, kind of it's ratcheted back to catastrophic.
Yeah, the most recent estimates that I've seen are that there were about 600,000 people on mainland Greece towards the end of the Late Bronze Age, and that had dropped to just over 300,000 by the early decades of the Iron Age. So that is huge, and that is where I would say some people are saying, oh, this is not a collapse. It's just a transformation. You talk about whitewashing. Oh, my God, that totally does away with the abject human misery that must have been there at that time. You get a population drop from 600,000 to just over 300,000 in the space of a century or so. It's not just a transformation.
Yeah. We're moving into, I mean, we should get now to the to talk about this use of the term Dark Ages or civilizational collapse. You don't like the term Dark Age, and let me push back against that. I would say that just what you said now. I mean, there are medieval historians who say, well, you know, the Black Death, wonderful opportunity. There is a labor surplus. You know, labor's a lot better after the Black Death. Serfdom basically dwindles away to nothing, because it's you can negotiate. Peasants have power. Opens up parliamentary government. What a hell of a thing the Black Death was. And it's like, yeah, except that kind of removes human misery by putting in lots of bar charts and tables and p-values. You can sort of... If you get rid of the narrative, you can forget that 50% of the population in some areas of Europe died. And as you just described in Mycenae, here we're going from, I mean, unimaginable, 90% dead or migrated. And we say, oh, no, not that bad. It's only 50%. It's staggering. So why should we be unwilling to call this a dark age?
So this has been argued by archaeologists for quite a while, ancient historians. And just like you mentioned just the Middle Ages, and the historians there don't like calling it a dark age anymore. It's now late antiquity and, you know, so on.
Early Middle Ages.
Yeah. Same thing with Bronze Age, Iron Age with us. At the turn of the millennium, from the second to the first. The archaeologists and ancient historians want to call it the Iron Age, which does not have any judgmental value attached to it. It's simply a statement that you're turning to iron. And they point to things like, in these centuries, from the 12th to the 8th, you have the standardization of the alphabet. You have the invention of iron. You have new things that are going to become a polis in Greece, the city states. You're going to eventually, and not too soon thereafter, or fairly soon thereafter, you're going to get concepts like democracy in Greece by, you know, the late 6th century or so. And they're now saying you can't call that a dark age. Now, you could argue, sure you can. It does match some of the characteristics. Right, a lower level of socio-political, a lower level of economy. People go back to the basics, especially in a place like Greece, where they really go into survival mode for a while before they build back up. But it depends where you look. If you look at Assyria and Babylonia, that's not a dark age. They're continuing. They've got the king, they've got the government, they've got the religion, they've got, you know, writing. It's not a dark age. And so people are saying it depends on where you look in this period. Yes, summer hit more than others. Some, you could say, well, it's a darkening of the age for a while. But overall, people are now tending to shy away from this. And we have to remember, too, that when archaeologists and ancient historians call a period a dark age, it frequently means something different to them than it would, you know, the general public. You say dark age, well, they're like, oh, barbarians on the night, right? People huddled in their ruins. No, a dark age for an archaeologist simply means that we don't know that much about it. It's dark to us. And that's why so often you see scholarly articles that are titled New Light Shown on the Dark Ages, right? New light on this. I know. There's lots of new light.
Wish we had five bucks for every one of those
exactly.
titles.
Yeah, right.
That's for
exactly.
sure.
Or a new light bulb for every one of them. Right. So we are learning more and more and more about this. And in fact, one of the preeminent historians, Chester Starr, taught at Michigan, he just 20 years ago, he said there's no other period that we've learned as much about recently as the Dark Ages, the Iron Age of Greece. So there's a big push on the part of the archaeologists and the ancient historians. Again, like getting rid of the Dorian invasion, they're saying, let's not call this the Dark Age. There may be some characteristics, but let's call it the Iron Age and go from there.
Okay, let's talk about let's finish up with briefly on the Iron Age. It's been 10 years since you published the first of your trilogy. and now the second volume has come out. How have you changed your mind in the last 10 years about the Iron Age? What's one or two things that you think differently now?
Okay, good question. And I should also mention that, yes, the original book came out 10 years ago, 2014, but so much new data came out almost immediately afterward that I put out a revised edition, which came out in 2021, and I revised some of my positions a bit. I jumped more on the climate change bandwagon, if you will, saying that I thought that drought and famine had been more of a stressor than I had previously been willing to give it credit for. So 2021, I would say, is the version that people should be looking at. But in terms of doing the research and the writing for this second volume, the after 1177, the main takeaway that I found is that the people that had been saying it's not a collapse, it's just a transformation, and I had been pushing back, no, it's a collapse, I now say it's more nuanced than I had given it credit for. And it is now, I argue in the beginning of this next book, that it's both a collapse and a transformation. What collapses is the globalized network, the interconnectedness. That network collapses, that's for sure. Though the links that had pulled together into a small world network, the G8, that's broken, that's gone. And it's going to take 400 years to build it back up. Now, the individual societies, the individual G8 members, they each deal with it differently. And that's what we've been talking about. Some are ones, some are threes, some are fives. Some are anti-fragile, some transform. Some just barely cope, and some don't do it at all. I had not thought it was that nuanced before I got into this period. And I found that it was absolutely fascinating to see how each of them reacted or not, and then thinking in terms of whether that was relevant to today. So I start out the book saying, this is going to be a much messier picture than we had in the previous book. We have 8 different case studies. And so to me, what happened was it made this period, the Iron Age, more interesting, fascinating, in fact. There is a divide in archaeology, and I mentioned this in the author's note at the end of the book. There are two divides, actually. There's a divide between...
Only two.
There's a divide between archaeologists who study the Bronze Age and archaeologists who study the Iron Age. It's basically the Iron Wall right there. There's also a divide between archaeologists who study the area of the Aegean and those who study the Eastern Mediterranean. And so what I've tried to do in this book is overcome both of those divides and look at both, you know, Bronze Age to Iron Age and Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean. And if you look at it that way, you get both a geographical continuum and a chronological continuum. And in fact, this this new book, I had originally written it chronologically, just like 1177 BC. So I had a chapter 12th century, then a chapter 11th century, then 10th, 9th, 8th. And I realized I was getting whiplash in each of the chapters. So I rearranged it and just said, this works better geographically. Let's look at what happened to the Assyrians. And let's look at what happened to the Babylonians and then the Hittites. And I think it makes much more sense to look at it as these eight case studies, because I think those then do have lessons for us today. So you're talking to a Bronze Age person who is an Iron Age convert. And I like the Iron Age as much as I like the Bronze Age now as a result of doing the research and the writing of this new book.
My guest today has been Eric H. Klein. He is the author most recently of After 1177 BC, The Survival of Civilizations. Eric, thank you so much for being once again part of Historically Thinking and looking forward to 770 BC. Is it right? After
1177, yeah. 776 BC, but I've only just
776
only
BC.
Just started researching and writing. It'll be a while before it's done, but thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And thanks so much to you as well for being part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, you can, of course, give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But by far the best way of helping us out is to share the podcast with a friend or with many friends. George McDonough is our producer. John Rutta is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.